Good morning. Here is our title for today as we have stage two of the book of Nehemiah. Let's just stay with the title for a minute. Why have we got this title? Yes, do wave your arm if you'd like a Bible in your hand to read. We'll come to read our chapter this morning in a moment. Kingdom building, that's the first part of it. What are we talking about? Kingdom building. In fact, Nehemiah, when he gets to Jerusalem, is going to build walls. He's going to rebuild the city. And so why are we saying kingdom building? It's in an attempt to relate it to our circumstances, because we're not Nehemiah, and we live in a totally different situation, but we're part of building God's purpose, God's church, God's kingdom. That's the first part of the title. And I had to confess, I struggled with the second half. And you might have seen different notices in anticipation of this morning, which have varied. We started with the title. It was on the list to begin with. Kingdom building depends on preparation. And I looked at the chapter and I read it and I thought, I'd like to start a bit further back than that with the vision that Nehemiah had. And so the title changed to what you got on your service sheet this morning: Kingdom Building Depends on Vision. But by the time I'd looked at the passage rather more carefully, I realized that, of course, it's all about preparation too. And the key factor, in fact, is the link between vision, which is all very well, but incomplete in itself, and has to be translated into action. And in this case, the preparation of Nehemiah before he ever gets to Jerusalem. So forgive me about this confusion, but we're into vision and preparation, okay? So let's read this passage. Nehemiah chapter 2, and it says verses 1 to 10 in your program. Forgive me, Johnny, but I'm just going to trespass into a couple of verses of the next passage, and you'll see why. It starts in the month of Nisan, and I just put that up because if you have a Hebrew background, that's significant. Nisan is for us, it's the month of April, roughly, but the meaning of this is that it's the month of salvation. It's the month of deliverance. And it probably isn't a coincidence that Nehemiah's great step of translating his vision into rescuing Jerusalem is in the month of Nisan. So verse 1, in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before, so the king asked me, "Why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart." I was very much afraid, but I said to the king, "May the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my fathers are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" The king said to me, what is it you want?" Then I prayed to the God of heaven. And I answered the king, "If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my fathers are buried, so that I can rebuild it." Then the king, with the queen sitting beside him, asked me, "How long will your journey take, and when will you get back?" "It pleased the king to send me, so I set a time. I also said to him, 'If it pleases the king, may I have letters to the governors of Trans-Euphrates, so that they will provide me safe conduct until I arrive in Judah?' And And may I have a letter to Asaph, keeper of the king's forest, so he will give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel by the temple, and for the city wall, and for the residence I will occupy. And because the gracious hand of my Lord was upon me, the king granted my request. So I went to the governors of Trans-Euphrates and gave them the king's letters. The king had also sent army officers and cavalry with me. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about this, they were very much disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites. I went to Jerusalem, and after staying there 3 days, I set out during the night with a few men. I had not told anyone what my God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. To be continued. Well, where are we? We're a long way from Jerusalem. We're in Susa, way out to the east. But there is breaking news from Jerusalem. And we had that in chapter 1 with Andy last week. I wasn't here, but I've tried to catch up with it. And simply, it was that those who have survived all the difficult years in Jerusalem are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down. The gates are burned with fire. And Nehemiah, in his first chapter, as we call it, says, "I wept. I mourned, I fasted." It really had a huge effect on him. "And I prayed before the God of heaven." And then he goes to the king. And the king knows nothing of this, but as Nehemiah comes to him the next day or whenever, the king cannot but notice that his whole demeanor has changed. And what I'm fascinated by is this statement: "This can be nothing but sadness of heart." Well, it's understandable from the king's point of view, but it's a huge misreading of what is happening in Nehemiah's spirit, in his heart. And the king has no idea of what Nehemiah has been through since he got this news, and has agonized over the state of Jerusalem and has wept and prayed. But then I noticed at the end of the reading another reference to Nehemiah's heart. By this time he has got to Jerusalem. We haven't got there yet, so we're just looking at this briefly in anticipation. And there he is, looking at this bleak prospect of a city in need, and this interesting statement: "At this point, I had not told anyone what God had put in my heart." And the challenge for us is to say, wow, what was that? What had God put in his heart? What had caused this tremendous action of Nehemiah in leaving a steady job, a safe environment, a comfortable situation there, and to go into a very challenging, difficult situation with Sanballat and other people opposing him with great vigor? Think about that for a bit. So here we are in Susa, and he's going to make this great journey with an uncertain outcome to Jerusalem. He's never been there. He's only heard of it. And so it's going into strange territory and into a difficult challenge. The walls are destroyed. They're burnt with fire. The gates, similarly. Did this happen last week? Did this happen last month? Did this happen last year? I just want for a moment to emphasize that this hasn't happened for a bit. And it raises the question, why is Nehemiah bothered with it now? This happened in 586. Okay, let's just, I know Andy gave the dates briefly last week, but I just like to drum it in, as it were, and do a little bit of a survey practically, and to get one or two of you to help me. 586. Let's just imagine, you know, the front of the church here is a timeline, all right, and that's over there, where we're about 600 years, okay, BC, before Christ. Okay, we go on for 100 years and we get to, I don't want to trick somebody into saying 700, all right, 500 years before Christ, and here we're 400 years before Christ, okay? And this happened in 586. 586 is when Jerusalem was destroyed, when those walls were burnt down, the temple was destroyed, and they went into exile. So, Paul, thanks very much. Here we are. There's one date, okay, near 600. And then here they are going into exile, and they went into exile at Babylon, because Nebuchadnezzar and co. had been the ones who brought God's judgment on his people in Jerusalem after years of failure and disobeying God. 586 before Christ. Now, we've just put another map up. Do you see the difference? It's no longer the Babylonian Empire. That has been overcome. And we're now in the Persian Empire, the capital of which has moved from Babylon, which was overcome, and is now Susa. And so all the exiles were moved there. And that's why Nehemiah is there. And that is in 538 BC. And that is when Cyrus, the emperor, could you do it, Raywin? Thanks. When Cyrus enabled a group to go back to Jerusalem. And, And on that visit, they were to restore the temple. But they went in 538 BC, but there were all sorts of problems. And it took another 20 years with the encouragement of Haggai and others to get that temple built. But that's another story. But that temple was built, and this was really stage one of the restoration, in not until 516 BC, all right? And so here we are. Thanks very much. Could you, where are we? This is 500, so about here, all right? Okay. So this is stage one, really, of the return, And that was the restoration or the rebuilding of the temple, and this was Zerubbabel, And that's 70 years later than the original going into exile. It was another 80 years before the next stage. The people were leaderless and without any guidance. And the guidance of God, of course, was his word, his law. And it was only when Ezra also took that journey I'm sorry about this. It's lost control. All right. It was only when Ezra went back and he brought the law before the people in 458. Thanks, Paul. All right. Okay. So about here. All right. Thanks very much. And and it was another 13 years, all right, before the events of today. Okay, thanks very much. Here we are. Okay, so that gives you the extent of it. Thank you very much indeed for your assistance. Yeah, we better give up on the pictures. And thank you. You can take your seats again. And I'll see if I can fill in the story without the pictures. And so my question is, can you do the arithmetic on that? How many years was that between 586, okay, and 445? It's 163 years, all right? 163 years. Now, just imagine, we are in 2017, and so we would need to go back to 1864. Okay, come on, quicker. 1864. Now, I don't know if you know what happened in 1864, but let me tell you. Queen Victoria was on the throne, okay? And in that year, there was the charge of the Light Brigade, you know, in our war with the Russians and Crimea. Does that affect anyone? What else? Oh, Oxford University, for the first time, allowed non-Anglican students to go to Oxford University, all right? Well, it doesn't raise too much interest. And there were other events, I've forgotten them now, but I didn't copy them all, but not very relevant to us. So why did something, 163 years before, affect Nehemiah so much? He's heard that the city where his ancestors are buried lies in ruins. So he does have some connections because his ancestors were there. But if you reflect on our worship this morning, he believes in the living God. The God who is in control of history and who has a purpose through history. And at some point... Yes? Oh, I see. Okay. Would you like to go on from there? Yeah. Okay. Thanks. And what he's heard about the city which God specially chose as the place for his presence, the place where people should worship him, the one who lives forever, as we've sung this morning. What has happened there is unacceptable, and he's deeply moved. And he says, it's unacceptable, but it is not inevitable. Something needs to be done about it. Something can be done about it. I don't know how to do it, but God will help me. And so as we apply to Nehemiah to our lives, we are looking around our own society. We're looking to the issues which affect our society, things which happen, and if we are moved by the word of God, there are some things where we say, that is unacceptable. It may be the homeless on the streets. It may be a situation where food banks are needed. It may be a situation where the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, and it's unacceptable before God. It's something which society has got used to, and everyone just justifies. And you could think of lots of things. Think about them in your groups. And you say, that is not acceptable. But life goes on because we've got work to do and, responsibilities and, oh, it's so busy and there are so many interesting things to do. Nehemiah says, no, we must take action. It is not inevitable that these things continue. And I have a responsibility before the living God to do something about it. And that begins to shape his vision and begins to, for us to see what is in his heart. The king observed nothing but sadness of heart. Little did he realize all that moved Nehemiah in regard to a sense of loyalty to God and the glory of God, which was being defaced in his society, among his people. And God put in his heart a great vision to do something about it. The Over and Out group have a title for the series they're doing at present, which I'd like just to borrow. I saw it when I put it in the prayer diary. They're looking at identity, dreams, and aspirations. And that seems to be a lovely summary for what is happening in Nehemiah's experience now. Let's begin with identity. We've already referred to that a bit. In chapter 2, verse 4, he says, I prayed to the God of heaven. We live in a world of many religions. We are in a society where our whole culture was shaped by a Christian identity, and that is now being lost. And it is difficult for us to work out our Christian way of life in the society which is increasingly losing its grip on the things which made our country a safe place, a moral place, a lawful place, a kind place in many respects. And people don't realize what the source of those blessings and inspiration was that led to those things. But Christians know that it is the God of heaven who has made a covenant of love with his people, who's acted in mercy towards us, who brings a transforming power which gives us a secret of life which we can make available to a society losing God. We have a loyalty and a responsibility to the God of heaven, and that's what Nehemiah felt. And in chapter 1, verse 5, we remember how he richly describes God in his prayer, the great and awesome God who keeps his covenant of love. How do we know about God's love? Well, because he first loved us and gave us our Lord Jesus Christ. That's anticipating things for Nehemiah, but that's from our standpoint. This is his identity. This is my identity. I've been born again of the life of God through his mercy, and I have a responsibility that my whole life should be to his glory. And we can say it in vague terms like that, forgive me, but it can be very vague sometimes. And what Nehemiah teaches us is that vision has to be made practical and to be worked out in the real situations of life, which we go on to. So his identity, in chapter 2, verse 5, is the city where his ancestors were buried. He has this sense of continuity. Jerusalem, where God had chosen to give his presence and reveal himself to his people. No longer the case. Jesus says, go. Jerusalem's finished. Go, and wherever you are, I'm with you. That's our identity. Jesus with us, yeah? So, it leads to dreams, which we perhaps would rather call vision. Dreams. What are our dreams? What are Nehemiah's dreams? Chapter 2, verse 5. let the king send me to the city in Judah where my ancestors are buried so that I can rebuild it. What a tremendous challenge he faced. He set out. What a tremendous ambition and dream. But in the strength of God, we're to be part of rebuilding or of building the kingdom in our society. In some ways, we could compare ourselves to Nehemiah because there have been times in this country when we have known the spirit of grace sweeping through this country. When Baptist churches were formed in the 1600s, the tremendous movement of independent Christians who went to prison and established churches across the country in the spirit of the Baptist history. In the 1700s, John Wesley on horseback across this country transformed the situation and led to so many of the ethical principles which came out of the evangelical faith which he established then. Through other times that we can think of through history, revival. Back. And there's a challenge to rebuild. We're losing the witness of faith. The church has been closing down for the last 100 years in this society. It's lovely to have people who come here from other parts of the world, where your experience is different. We lived in Zambia for 10 years, and Zambia was great. The church was growing. It was the new thing. It was the thing which was exciting. There were no buildings which were now fish shops or furniture stores, you know. There were new buildings all over the place, new churches. And some of you come from places across the world where the church is growing. Please teach us. Please bring your expectation, your energy, your concern to make the gospel known, that we might relearn it in our society. There's the dream. And so, thirdly, aspirations. Can I just change that from aspirations to something more, to actual plans, and more particularly to practical plans? And that is Nehemiah's example. As you see in chapter 2 in verse 4, he's very practical. He gives to the king a timetable of what he would like to do. He's thought out what he's going to do, and he's taking action. Secondly, in verse 7, he asks for letters of authority. And thirdly, in verse 8, he's practical, and he asks for building materials. And this is a lovely illustration of the vision, the dream, being translated into practical reality. And I think that's our particular challenge this morning. As a fairly settled church, and the whole model of church life in this country has to be stable, all right? It's a model in politics as well. Sorry, you didn't know. But God isn't into stability in that sense. He's into action and movement and flexibility and expectation of change. And Nehemiah is preparing for that. Yeah. Now, let's translate this into modern life. I'm always fascinated by the new watchword in sort of business circles, and so on. I thought, well, that's a Bible idea they've pinched. That's a Bible idea. These people working in this busy office, this company will occasionally, I'm imagining this, they'll occasionally take them away for a day, all right, and say, stop working for a minute and let's think what we're doing. Okay, and they'll have some subject like this. They'll have, take one of the sort of ideas of the present. They will talk about integrated personal development. Well, that's what's happened with Nehemiah. Okay. And they will look at slogans like this. Your life does not get better by chance, it gets better by change. That's a good biblical idea, all right? The God's work doesn't go forward by people sitting around and just wanting to be comfortable and life to be predictable and the church program just to continue without too much to disturb it. Vision, the sort of vision God gives, brings change. And I must learn how to be a changer, a change person, a change agent, yeah? They will stress certain things like personal development and we need to check whether, I mean, it's been a blessing over these last few months for the emphasis on gifts, because that's the whole idea, that we are open to gifts that God gives us as individuals. And it's just not simply recognizing that, it's then doing something about it and taking action and developing that into practice. Yeah. And it deals with all these subjects. This is what people are dealing with in commercial situations when they had a day off and their staff days. And of course, this is what we're talking about in regard to Nehemiah, the aspirations and dreams as human talent is put to work to change the quality of life. And there'll be a slogan like this one. It's difficult to read if you twist this way. Limitations live only in our minds. But if we use our imaginations, our possibilities become limitless. And for Nehemiah, he's going into that limitless situation. He's got something in his mind which is going to come out in practice. And so what is in our hearts today? That's the question. Are we looking for the next stage of what God is doing in our life to develop us? And are we cooperating with that? And what are our plans for this week and the next 3 months and the next year in the purpose of God to bring what excites us into actuality? And so, vision and preparation. The vision and the preparation go together, and several elements go together in this story, yeah? Vision depends on what's in the heart, and we read how Nehemiah prayed to the God of heaven. His vision is worked out in fellowship with God, but notice this, he requests assistance from the king. The king isn't a follower of the eternal God. He's part of the human scene, but he requests assistance from the king. That's a very interesting balance. It's a balance between prayer and action. And they go together. And there are some people who are so spiritual, they'll only pray. You mustn't rely on human agencies, you know. You mustn't look for that. God, if you're going to do something, he will do it. No, says Nehemiah. We ask the God of heaven and we use all that's available on earth. Prayer and action go together. Yep. And action, yep. He seeks help from heaven and earth. Interesting balance. And of course, the other problem is also there, that we can simply do it in human strength. But Nehemiah, of course, gives us this balance. He speaks first to the God of heaven. In fact, he speaks all through at every point. Even when he's talking to the king, he's praying to the God of heaven as he speaks. Help from heaven and earth. Christian work, which doesn't deal with both the spiritual dimension and the human realities, is unbalanced. Yeah. But they must be together, and, yeah. So he makes practical plans. There they are, the timetable, the letters of authority, the building materials. Vision depends on what's in our hearts. Yeah. To turn what is unacceptable, to prevent it from being inevitable. Yeah. And it's just been lovely to see particularly in Andy and Sarah, the way they've tackled Malden Manor. And all the hope we have, the vision that we have for the church plant in Malden Manor. It's been a lovely combination. Andy's preaching at Teddington just now, so remember him as he preaches. But it's been a lovely combination of reliance on the Lord, consulting the Lord, asking for the Lord's help, but activity on the ground where Andy and others have related to, you know, Muslim shopkeepers and the officials of the Southwest trains and the head of the school, the secondary school, and so on. The lovely balance between prayer and action. Let's pray that that continues, vision and action, on through, week by week. We pray for them. This month's prayer diary has got particular emphasis on the young people and the young people's groups. Can we truly pray for them? And pray towards the autumn when we're going to need new people working as some go off to Malden Manor. And what about special activities for children and young people? I'm just thinking of holiday clubs, beach missions, camps for young people. Have you thought of giving your summer holiday, if you have got to one or prepare for next year, to working with children in the summer? The wonderful work which goes on. Because medical students, Christian medical students, gave up their summer holiday and came to my beach in Cornwall, I came to know Christ. Because they put vision into action. Yeah. There are so many people in this community who live on their own. And it's not acceptable that they have no visitors most of the week, that they don't relate to people, that they don't feel any caring. It's unacceptable. But it's not inevitable if there are people available who will get the vision and go perhaps and visit people regularly, a regular commitment. Now, there are so many things one might suggest, and I've been a bit, you know, just oddly selective in things, but how do you plan in the next, say, 3 months to put vision into action? One more suggestion. Our culture is losing the Bible. And the reality is that the church is losing the Bible too because people are too busy to read it. And I remember being challenged once when I was with other leaders at an interchurch thing, and the person working with us said, "What are you leading? How are you leading? Are you expecting to preach on Sundays? Do you work with young people? You're handling the Bible? Do you spend time with the Bible? Do you spend extra time? Are you careful in getting aware of it more, in learning it so that you can pass it on, all the riches of the grace of God in the Word?" He said, let me ask you, in the next 3 months, he said, something like this, he said, "What are you planning to read? What is on your reading list for the next 3 months? What action are you taking to grow as a teacher, as a leader in your community, whatever it is?" And life is too busy for that, isn't it, for most people? Yeah. Vision depends what's in the heart, and true vision leads to action and change. And this lovely statement at the end about what God had put in his heart. Let's bring our hearts to the Lord and ask that we might truly have vision for changing what is unacceptable around us. I just love, finally, what Solomon said about his father David when he dedicated the temple he had built. He said, "You know that my father David, he wanted to build this temple. It was in his heart to build this temple. That was not God's purpose, but I want you to know that. And in fact, the Lord said to my father David, you did well to have it in your heart." And I'm just thinking of the reality that for some of us, we do have dreams, we have visions, and we put our effort into it, but we may not see fruit. It may not be fulfilled. And other people may not know what is in our heart. And that may depress us. But God knows. And God says, it is well that is in your heart. I look at the heart and not the outward appearance that everybody else sees. And it's your heart I want to be right. Do you want to do good things, great things, kind things, fruitful things for me? That's what I want you to have in your heart. And a readiness to change and to put it into action and to plan for the next stage. May the Lord give us this grace to make vision into action. Thanks.